You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 29th of March 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London with me, Tom Edwards. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, North Korea continues to kick sand in the face of the United States and Seoul by putting its missile units on standby. We ask what would happen should a real conflict begin.
We must make clear that these provocations by the North are taken by us very seriously and we'll respond to that.
US Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel there. And our editor Andrew Tuck joins us to look back at the stories topping our agenda on Monocle 24 this week.
So Germany has airlifted in literally billions of euros to save this nation. The interesting thing is when you don't go over a certain size of population, there is this sense of social cohesion. So you can actually persuade a whole country to come along with you on a certain mission.
And we hit the slopes of, no, not Chamonix, but Bamiyan, Afghanistan, with the founder of the Afghan ski race.
That's the other side of having like 30 years of war. There was just no tourism there for the last 30 years. So you have it all for yourself and you have the slopes for yourself every morning. You don't have to get up at 6 to have the first line.
All that, plus we play some great music too. All to come in the next hour right here on Midori House. Plenty to look forward to on today's show. So much to fit into just 60 short minutes. How are we going to do it? Stay tuned and you'll find out. Before all of that, let's catch up on the latest news with Bill Bingham.
Monocle 24 News. Russia is warning of tensions in North Korea slipping towards a vicious circle after Pyongyang said it was putting its missile units on standby. According to the country's state news agency, President Kim Jong-un made the order in response to US stealth bomber flights over the Korean peninsula. Annual military drills and new UN sanctions have angered North Korea, which has named mainland bases and bases in Hawaii, Guam, and South Korea as potential targets. US Republican Bob Corker, who's on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, says they're prepared for whatever may happen.
Obviously, in our country, we're building additional missile interceptors, and I met with General Thurman this morning, who handles our U.S. operations, and they're prepared for anything that might take place. But hopefully what will occur is cooler heads will prevail, and this will de-escalate, and hopefully we can have fruitful negotiations about the future. And my sense is that's what's going to happen.
School children are among at least 45 people missing in the rubble of a building that's collapsed in Dar es Salaam in Tanzania. At least 3 people have died, but many others are under the rubble, with some desperate survivors calling for help using their mobile phones. Hundreds of residents and army rescuers are using their bare hands to search through piles of rubble after the collapse, which happened in an affluent area of the country's economic capital. Cyprus's president Nikos Anastasiades says his country has contained the risk of bankruptcy following a tough rescue package with the EU. He says they have no intention of leaving Europe's single currency. Mr. Anastasiades says the government will implement the necessary reforms in order to encourage investment and restore the economy. But he's criticised Cyprus's partners in the 17-nation eurozone, accusing them of making unprecedented demands that forced Cyprus to become an experiment. There have been chaotic scenes and a thrown shoe after Pakistani judges extended bail for Pervez Musharraf in the southern city of Karachi on Friday. The former president returned to Pakistan last Sunday after more than 4 years of self-exile to take part in forthcoming elections, despite the possibility of arrest and death threats from the Taliban. Mr. Musharraf's bail has been extended for another 2 weeks in one case, and he's been granted a 21-day extension in the other 2 cases. South Africa's President Jacob Zuma says Nelson Mandela is making steady progress after spending a second day in hospital for treatment for a lung infection. It's reported the 94-year-old is in good spirits and enjoyed a full breakfast. Former President Mandela contracted TB in the 1980s, when he was an inmate at Robben Island Prison. His lungs were also damaged while he was working in the prison quarry. The uncle of the Olympic and Paralympic athlete, Oscar Pistorius, says his nephew does not intend to travel abroad despite having his passport returned to him in a relaxation of his bail conditions. Pistorius is awaiting trial, accused of murdering his girlfriend, Reva Steenkamp, a charge he denies. A judge in Pretoria lifted some of his strict bail conditions on Thursday. As well as having his passports returned, he's no longer required to visit a probation officer. His uncle, Arnold Pistorius, says family members believe in him.
We know the facts. We know exactly what was going on because we... Oscar's not a liar. He's the one thing, he's got a lot of mistakes. But the one thing he's never done is lying. And so we trust what he said to us as the facts, and it was a terrible, terrible mistake.
220 holidaymakers have been rescued from two ice floes which went adrift off the Latvian coast. Emergency craft and helicopters were sent to rescue stranded ice anglers and their families in the Gulf of Riga. Winds and high waves sent the ice they were on away from the shore and out into the Gulf. One of the floes had broken away at one of Riga's most popular beaches, Vakabuli Beach, and another a few miles down the coast. One man trapped on the ice floe said there'd been no panic and people had boarded the boats to safety. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Bill. 6 minutes past the hour here on Monocle 24. We'll be talking more about North Korea in just a moment. But you're with Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're with Midori House, with me, Tom Edwards, live from Studio One here in London. Now, like a small angry man intent on picking fights with those bigger and stronger than himself, North Korea continues to adopt a position of open hostility to not just its southerly neighbour, but its big friend, the United States of America. The hardly battle-hardened, yet keen-to-impress leader, Kim Jong-un, today signed an order to put his missile units on standby after the US and Seoul underwent military drills on the Korean Peninsula. According to the state news agency KCNA, Kim is quoted as saying the time had come to settle accounts with the United States. Big words indeed, but what would happen if this regional bar brawl were actually to kick off? Heather Williams, Research Fellow in International Security at Chatham House, joins me on the line to discuss this further. Heather, let's talk about North Korea in terms of the actual capabilities of the kind of sides involved here. We're kind of used to the saber-rattling that goes on. What kind of potential does North Korea actually have? And what do you think they're likely to do if indeed the situation did progress further beyond saber-rattling into real action?
It's a great question because we really do need to focus on what are the facts and what are their capabilities. So starting with that, North Korea doesn't have a capability to reach the continental United States. So a lot of these recent statements about how Kim Jong-un wants to hit D.C. or New York, they really don't have that ability. So, but what they do have the ability to do is to target U.S. allies in the region like South Korea or Japan. So that's what the real concern is here. In terms of their nuclear capabilities, we think they have somewhere around 10 nuclear weapons. But the problem is we really don't know if those are deliverable by missiles because North Korea has a habit of not having really good technology despite all their testing. But it doesn't seem like they have the capability to present this real serious threat that they seem to be talking about doing.
Now, Heather, tell me, if they did decide to make some kind of gesture or something more serious than that in terms of an actual threat, possibly, as you say, to the south, what do you think the response would be? Because clearly there's a lot of different interests here. You know, China doesn't want to see some kind of dreadful nuclear landscape near to its borders. South Korea will obviously have its own concerns about, you know, potential reunification, even if we look that far down the line. What do you think any sort of countermeasure would look like, both from the South and, more importantly, from the United States?
Right. Well, as you say, there are a couple layers of this. I think the three most important layers are the broader international response, the U.S. and South Korea. At the international level, just recently, China's been coming out and stressing caution, and kind of saying, you know, everybody calm down and trying to keep things as calm as possible. And also recently, Russian Minister Lavrov came out and said that he was concerned that this could escalate into some spiral and of conflict. So the international community really is doing everything to try to just keep everybody calm and keep tensions from escalating to the point of war. From the U.S. side, the U.S. is quite clearly, firmly, and officially committed to the security of South Korea. It's had a security agreement with them for decades. The U.S. has 28,500 troops in South Korea. And the exercises that are going on right now with South Korea, that's part of a demonstration of the U.S. commitment to that relationship.
So it's very interesting, isn't it, Heather, to then look at the potential responses in a bit more detail. I wonder, what would the U.S. reaction then really look like if it did come to making, a meaningful statement militarily? We know that they would act if there was a threat or an action directed towards the South. What do you think their response would really look like? Would we see missile drops? How would you characterize it? Or is it one of these things where it's actually rather impossible to say?
I think it's impossible to say because we don't know what the North would do. The U.S. response would really depend on what North Korea does. If North Korea attacks the islands again, if they attack South Korean submarines as they've done in the past, or if they, if they move troops in the demilitarized zone, all of those options would just have a different response on the U.S. part. So we really just don't know.
And Heather, tell me about the importance then of the kind of joint military drills that we see so often, particularly between South Korea and the United States. How much of the kind of general strategic planning relies upon these kind of military drills? Is it the sorts of responses and reactions that would actually happen in a kind of combat situation? Are these things run through in these drills, or are these really almost more as a display of both military might and of their unity? Is it more about that?
They're a mixture of both. To be sure, these exercises are thought through well beforehand. They go through a lot of different scenarios and game planning, and that determines what type of exercises they're going to use and what type of military aircraft and capabilities they're going to demonstrate. So a lot of it is based on scenario planning and gaming out what would happen if North Korea did attack the South in some way. But as you say, the other side of this is a demonstration of the commitment to the South. And so the exercises that are going on right now with the B-52 that flew over and now the U-2 plane that flew over North Korea, the spy plane, this is all part of a demonstration of the commitment of the U.S. to South Korea.
And Heather, tell me, I'm intrigued by this. We kind of characterise this relationship as the sort of small, angry man, you know, pecking a barroom fight with someone much bigger and stronger to sort of try and show a bit of machismo. Is it possible that we in the West sometimes make rather flippant remarks about this? Is there a possibility that we've totally underestimated the kind of potential that North Korea has, the kind of capabilities they have? Or do you think we're pretty sure on our ground when we describe their military potential?
In terms of their military potential, we can be pretty confident in terms of what we know. But as you rightfully point out, this just because they can't reach the continental United States, just because their technology, it's not always proven, that North Korea can still do a lot of damage and does present a serious threat to the region. So it is important not to take it lightly. And as you say, it is so easy to just create this caricature. It's kind of the Team America syndrome that we're still living with, where you see the Kim dynasty in this cartoonish way. But it is important to remember, as the Russians urged us to today, that this could escalate and this could become a very serious conflict.
Absolutely. And Heather, I obviously don't want to put you on the spot because it is rather hard to predict, especially as we've talked about Kim Jong-un. You know, he is a rather unpredictable character. But what do you think will happen next as we sort of look ahead a few more weeks, a few more months, possibly once he settles into his role and becomes more of a familiar face? What do you think we'll actually see? Are we wrong to fear actual military action, or do you think we might really see this boiling over in the few months ahead?
I think one of the turning points when we're going to know what to expect will be when these exercises end, which is early to mid-April. So the biggest exercise going on right now is Operation Full Eagle. And I think that a lot of the posturing by the Kim regime right now is because of these exercises and is in response to the increased U.S. military presence in the region. So I think that once these exercises start to wind down, and we'll see whether or not the U.S. does what role the U.S. continues to play in the region, I think that's going to be the turning point of when we know what Kim's plans and intentions are. Because at that point, when the exercises are over, the U.S. isn't going to be around as much for Kim to shake his fist at and to use as an excuse for this kind of rhetoric and this posturing. So even once the exercises are over, if he continues with that, then I think we still need to be quite concerned. But I would say that's the turning point. And beyond that, I couldn't possibly speculate.
Well, you've made a pretty decent fist of answering that question, Heather. That's Heather Williams, Research Fellow in International Security at Chatham House. Coming up next, a roundup of the stories that dominated our agenda this week on Monocle 24. I'll be welcoming the editor of the magazine, Andrew Tuck, and Monocle's producer and presenter, Marcus Hippi, onto the show.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight from Beirut to Bogota, Sydney to Singapore.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delaunay.
From Monocle.
For Monocle.
In Tel Aviv.
From Monocle.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dane.
From Monocle, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
From Monocle. In Hong Kong, I'm Liv Levitchnik.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
In Bogota.
So whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the ateliers of the best design companies, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24. Keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to Midori House right here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. Now, it's that time of the week and indeed of the programme when we look back on the week in news with a select band of Monocle editors. I'm delighted to say today I'm joined here in Studio One by our editor, Andrew Tuck, and by the redoubtable Marcus Hippi, who also joins me round the desk. I think we should start by looking at Korea. We've been covering this week in quite a lot of detail. We talk about saber rattling and the sort of whys and wherefores, what would happen. But it's really interesting, I think, that the North, even beyond their usual flamboyance, has seemed to really up the rhetoric this week. And it's kind of interesting to look at what they might actually be capable of doing, isn't it, Andrew?
It is. I think there's been a bit of dictator speak. And I think also one of the kind of the worst uses of Photoshop going. It's funny how dictators kind of fall for Photoshop. They believe that you can kind of airbrush in a few kind of extra hovercraft and you'll kind of convince people south of the border that you have a kind of credible force. But in fact, it didn't take more than a few pictures editors just to look at those pictures and see that they had kind of just kind of done cut and paste to kind of, you know, up the numbers of their troops. And it's not the first time that we've seen this happen. The Iranians got used to kind of photoshopping extra fighter jets into the sky. And of course, it's an honourable tradition almost, going back to the times of Stalin, when if he fell out with someone, he'd have them just kind of cut out the picture. And, a bit of Photoshop has never gone amiss. But it is funny the way that North Koreans are kind of, you know, their bellicoseness, their photoshopping. It's a lot of noise. And I think that what's interesting is that I think whether you're sitting in, you know, Washington or whether you're sitting in Seoul, you can't quite tell which bit is, as you say, saber rattling and which bit is actually a real threat.
I think that's also the thing that when we are covering this story, it kind of becomes quite repetitive. Every now and then there's something new coming from North Korea. Once again, North Korea threatens that it's going to turn this and this city into a sea of flames. But what else is there? We kind of realize that we're asking pretty much the same questions because the situation is not really going forward anywhere. They just come up with new rhetorics.
And it's interesting, isn't it, beyond the rhetoric, to look at the personalities. I find, and I know, Andrew, you've remarked about this before, the actual characters involved. You look particularly at the sort of leadership, and he does seem a stranger. He's very youthful, and you almost look like you feel a bit like he's almost a child who's been caught up in an adult's world, almost.
He behaves, you know, like a spoilt child. And when you see those photos of the kind of like the generals who have managed to survive all the purges over the years kind of standing around him, they're all kind of in their doddery 80s with kind of uniforms that haven't been updated actually since the Korean War, then you kind of, you know, you just see this kind of really badly behaved child who's kind of getting his own way. And you do wonder who's still making those kind of catsuits for him, those nice flared trousers.
By the way, did you see the picture of him playing with this military computer that was also published this week? It's a really fascinating photo. I was looking at it for a long time. Because the computer itself looks like it's directly from 1969.
And even when you see him doing like the war manoeuvres, he's got like the papers in front of him. It's just like one of those, you know, Second World War films where you see someone with a long stick moving the kind of planes across the board. He is kind of, you know, he is the kind of, you know, the modern impersonation of that kind of, you know, evil Dr. No kind of character.
He's certainly fun. Well, I shouldn't say fun to look at, but it's
strange thing
is,
we can't. Yeah, there is a tragicomedy element to it, and that's what's worrying is we don't really know which bit of it's serious and which bit of it is him just being a little bit of a kind of dictator buffoon, to be honest.
Let's move on to another topic, which again we've covered in depth, and I suppose it's fair to say again has an air of tragicomedy. Cyprus and the ongoing travails, will they, won't they, will they collapse, the bailout. People seem, certainly who we've talked to in Nicosia, to be, if not optimistic, perhaps more upbeat than we might have expected. There's almost a sense of a lifting of a burden, you know, that there could be some positivity. And it's interesting to consider Cyprus, not just economically, but politically, you know, could what we're seeing now change this very complex dynamic in the country between, for example, you know, the north and the rest of the country. Do you think that this could be a potentially a watershed for Cyprus?
I think it's a lesson learned for all of these countries. We've seen the same happen in Iceland. You have these countries that thought they were going to be, you know, huge financial services centres, and they were kind of overbanked, is the word. There was so much kind of capital sitting in their banks, it was ridiculous in comparison to the country's GDP. So in that way, it's a kind of cleansing that, you know, that is not going to be their future. They had hoped to kind of survive on natural gas deposits off the coast, but even that doesn't seem likely. So it's going back to your roots. So it's a bit like when the doctor tells you, I'm really sorry, but you're going to have your leg cut off. Of course, you're very worried about it before, but actually once it's done, you get the wooden leg, you can kind of hobble off again and away you go. It's not perhaps as terrifying as you thought, but it is a kind of, is it back to basics for the country? And the strange thing is that that's, you know, one of the reasons we did the German cover on Monocle two issues ago, because, you know, the sad reality is that all these countries are dependent on Germany. They don't like it, they don't like being told what to do. But they need Germany. And so Germany has, you know, airlifted in literally, you know, billions of euros to save this nation. But people don't like it. But there is a connection with Finland, because I think that the interesting thing is when you don't go over a certain size of population, there is this sense of social cohesion. So you can actually persuade a whole country to come along with you on a certain mission. So that, I know that happened in Finland in its past at troubled moments. And I think that's the good thing about the size of Cyprus. There's a few enough people that you can actually say, come on, we're all in this together. We're all going to lose a bit of money, but then we can get on with things.
It's really fascinating. Another interesting story this week, which has received a lot of coverage around the world, is the issue of gay marriage, gay rights. And I think there's been quite an interesting, we talk about watershed moments. It's interesting, a lot of countries and states are legislating it around the same time. And it was interesting, Marcus, you talk about finding a Finnish angle. We've been focusing a lot on the court case in the US. Just very briefly, what's the attitude towards this in Finland? Is it the same kind of debates that are being had there as we're seeing in France and the US and the UK?
There is definitely something happening now internationally. It's not, the discussion is not taking place just in the US, also in Finland all of a sudden. Finland is the last remaining Nordic country that doesn't allow same-sex marriage. But I think that is about to change. There's a new way for Finnish citizens to bring new topics for the parliament to discuss. And one of them now, this new system requires 50,000 names on a list. And basically, there's a petition to collect these names now in Finland. And already, in just a matter of week or so, they managed to get 140,000 names supporting same-sex marriage, which means that it's over 2% of the Finnish population, which means it's actually this incentive is now more popular than one of the Christian parties in Finland that has been traditionally very much against the same-sex marriage. So I think that's actually something that is going to become even more heated discussion topic in Finland. And I think that Finland may actually join the other Nordic countries in this topic. It's going to become a country that actually allows same-sex marriage when we just wait until the parliament is going to deal with this in the autumn.
Really interesting to watch. Andrew, just very briefly on this. It's interesting, isn't it, that we seem to be seeing a lot of these debates in a lot of sort of Western liberal democracies kind of coalescing around the same issues at the same time. What do you think the drivers for that are? Is it a shared sort of social responsibility, interest in the same social issues, or do you think there are other forces at play that mean this is coming to the fore at the same time?
I think there's two or three things that are happening. I do think that countries, you know, have gone through these long periods of, you know, equal rights, whether it's for, you know, women or for based on race or based on sexuality, and there's a kind of coming of age, and there's a generation who are growing up who, you know, maybe there's some schoolroom teasing, but actually most young people don't give a damn. And I think most people accept that whoever you are, and not just on questions of sexuality, you should be entitled to the same goods and services, no matter, you know, who you're born to, what family you were born to, into, or whatever your sexuality. So that's just accepted. And I think there's also just a realization at every level that, you know, if you want to employ the best people for your company, if you want your country to run well, you have to offer people equal rights. So a really basic thing, if you're an American guy who falls in love with another guy who's not American, at the moment, bad luck. You're going to have to move abroad because, you know, you have no legal right in many states to bring that person into the country. Well, what if you happen to be a top executive in a company? Do you move your job overseas? Do you come to Europe? So I think there's a bit of competition actually at an economic level. Countries recognise that they have to offer the best environments for people to work. So there's an economic drive, and it's not really a moral push, I think, from these governments. Yes, a belief that everyone should be entitled to equal rights, but a real recognition that it's healthy for your economy.
It's a really fascinating one, I'm sure we'll revisit. Certainly those were some of the big stories that dominated this week. Marcus Tippi, Andrew Tuck, thanks very much for discussing them in this little review of the week here on Midori House.
The Review is Monocle 24's weekly review and preview of the arts. Every Saturday, we take a relaxed look back at the books, TV shows, films, music, theatre and events that have made our week, while looking around the corner to scout out the next big thing.
It doesn't feel sappy, it doesn't feel sentimental. It does have a certain heft.
It's very Darwinian. The shows that do well run and the ones that don't close. And there have been some quite high-profile flops and some great successes as well.
For me, it's riotous, it's tasteless, but it's actually dynamic as well. It has momentum.
Join Monocle's editors as they sit down with our favourite critics, opinion makers and key industry figures for some in-depth discussion and lively debate. And we provide inspiration for the weekend from cities around the world.
It's a real divider because I know some people just love this film and other people really just hate it.
That's a review every Saturday at midday London time and across the weekend, right here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. Now, in a moment, we're going to be going skiing. Not in Switzerland or Austria or somewhere like that, but in Afghanistan. That's right. So let's keep it kind of alpine themed. Let's listen to a song, Mountain Sound. This is by Of Monsters and Men. Of Monsters and Men with Mountain Sound. We'll be visiting the mountains again in a little while, because in the next half hour of the programme, as well as hearing from the author Geoffrey Parker about his new book, Global Crisis, War, Climate Change and Catastrophe in the 17th Century, we'll also be heading to the slopes of Afghanistan.
That's the other side of having like 30 years of war. There was just no tourism there for the last 30 years. So you have it all for yourself, and you have the slopes for yourself every morning. You don't have to get up at 6. To have the first line.
That's all still to come. Before all that, let's hear the latest news headlines from Bill Bingham.
Russia is warning of tensions in North Korea slipping towards a vicious circle after Pyongyang said it was putting its missile units on standby. According to the country's state news agency, President Kim Jong-un made the order in response to US stealth bomber flights over the Korean Peninsula. Annual military drills and new UN sanctions have angered North Korea, which has named mainland bases and bases in Hawaii, Guam and South Korea as potential targets. Schoolchildren are among at least 45 people missing in the rubble of a building that's collapsed in Dar es Salaam in Tanzania. At least 3 people have died, but many others are under the rubble, with some desperate survivors calling for help using their mobile phones. Hundreds of residents and army rescuers are using their bare hands to search for survivors. Cyprus's president, Nikos Anastasiades, says his country has contained the risk of bankruptcy following a tough rescue package with the EU. And he says they have no intention of leaving Europe's single currency. There have been chaotic scenes and a thrown shoe after Pakistani judges extended bail for Parvez Musharraf in the southern city of Karachi on Friday. The former president returned to Pakistan last Sunday after more than 4 years of self-exile to take part in forthcoming elections. despite the possibility of arrest and death threats from the Taliban. South Africa's president, Jacob Zuma, says Nelson Mandela is making steady progress after spending a second day in hospital for treatment for a lung infection. It's reported the 94-year-old is in good spirits and enjoyed a full breakfast. 220 holidaymakers have been rescued from two ice floes which went adrift off the Latvian coast. Emergency craft and helicopters were sent to rescue stranded ice anglers and their families in the Gulf of Riga. Winds and high waves sent the ice they were on away from the shore and out into the Gulf. And that's, those are the latest headlines here on Monocle 24.
Now, while some may be tempted by the secure, snowy escapes of Samaritz, Chamonix or Whistler, other more daring types can flee to the far-flung expanses of alpine Afghanistan, near the top of the list of places to go, to stretch your ski legs as well as enjoy some Sunni Islamism. Such is the view, at least, of the creators of the Afghan Ski Challenge, a freeride ski race which takes place every March in the Bamiyan province of central Afghanistan, fearlessly promoting alpine tourism despite the not inconsiderable regional instability. A quick glance on the website, you see a few caveats and warnings. From the fairly obvious, the mountains of Afghanistan are not the Alps, nor the Rocky Mountains, to the rather more alarming, there is no mountain rescue, nor avalanche warning systems in place, and local medical facilities are basic, to perhaps least encouragingly, mobile phone service is patchy at best and non-existent in the mountains. I'm booking my ticket already. And I'm delighted to say that the founder of the race, Christoph Zerker, joins me now. Christoph, thank you for joining me on Midori House. I wanted to start by asking you, just give us some of the background to this. Why exactly did you decide, why were you so keen to launch this event?
Well, actually, at the beginning, I wasn't really keen. It was just an idea. I got stuck for a couple of days and due to some security reasons, and my embassy didn't want me to move anymore, and I was really stuck in Bamiyan, and then I was looking at these mountains for days and days, and for a Swiss, it doesn't really take that long to think about skiing, and that was probably the beginning of the idea, and a couple of months later, I brought some skis and equipment to Bamiyan, and then we started.
Fantastic. And I just wonder, how would you characterise the skiing in Bamiyan province? Compare it, if you can, to the more traditional areas we associate with skiing. What makes it so special?
Well, the main difference is probably that it's absolutely undeveloped. I mean, that's the other side of having like 30 years of war. There's just no tourism. There was just no tourism there for the last 30 years. So you have it all for yourself, and you have the slopes for yourself every morning. You don't have to get up at 6 to have the first line. So that's probably the main difference. But the other difference is really that the snow is really special because the climate is so dry. You have really fluffy snow, something that you probably only have in Canada, like in a similar way. And this is on a latitude of Morocco, so suntan isn't the problem as well.
Wow, it sounds really lovely, Christoph. I just wonder, who are the sort of people who are taking advantage of these amazing conditions and coming along to ski then in Bamiyan province? Is it people from a lot of the big European skiing hotspots, you know, from Switzerland and Austria, North Americans? Who are some of the people who are taking advantage?
No, right now it's mostly people who are already kind of associated with Afghanistan, or they have probably already worked there, mainly in Kabul. From Kabul, it's just a 20-hour flight or so. But for the ski race this year, we had, I think, 4 Australians, 6 from France, 1 woman from Slovenia, and a couple of US people. So it's all over the place.
Wonderful. It sounds like a lovely international sort of group get-together. Just tell me about some of the other objectives then. Obviously, you want people to discover the amazing skiing there is there. What else are you hoping to achieve? You know, what could this mean, do you think, for the region and for Afghanistan?
Well, I mean, you obviously have, like, the direct consequences, like more people coming there. You have hotels being booked out instead being empty during winter. But it also has kind of, that's what I actually discovered myself in the last 2 years. I didn't think about that at the beginning. Kind of a tremendous symbolic meaning for the people in Afghanistan as well. Because, you know, that's something we actually mostly forget in a place like Afghanistan. There's hardly any occasion to come together just to have fun. I mean, people come together to demonstrate or even worse. So to just have an occasion to come together for fun, because gives the people also like the feeling that not all things go downhill.
Absolutely. Well, apart from the skiing, of course. But tell me, aside from the obviously all of those positive aspects, I mean, there are some issues, are there not, with safety and security? We've mentioned a little bit about how obviously there's no rescue services, avalanche warnings. Is it a problem, do you think, that there aren't these kind of security measures that you'd normally expect when you go skiing?
It probably would be a problem for people who hadn't backcountry skied before, but I don't really advise anybody who isn't really into backcountry skiing to go there. I mean, you have to be able to help yourself, but I think that's also kind of the appeal, because in the Alps or in the US, you just call the next helicopter and then you're out of a problematic situation, and in a place like Bamiyan, you have to deal it out yourself. And I think that's something that appeals to some, like, kind of a segment of adventure tourists as well, I guess.
And Christoph, just tell me finally, the actual Afghan ski challenge, so it's a free ride ski race. Just tell me a little bit about the course. What are the rules? How does the race actually work?
Well, the rules are really pretty easy. Everybody starts at the same time, and then it goes up for about like half an hour, 40 minutes, maybe 1 hour for the slower ones. And then on the other side, you race down again. And that makes it actually quite hard for even experienced skiers to beat the Afghans, because it's the altitude is really high. We started like 2,600 meters elevation or so. So since now, we never had a Westerner faster than like I think fifth place or something like that.
Well, you never know. This year might just be the first one. But Christoph, thanks very much for joining us, and best of luck with the ski challenge. That's Christoph Zerker joining me on the line, the founder of the Afghan Ski Challenge. You're with Midori House.
If you think the print industry is on its last legs, then you haven't tuned into The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly review of the best in paper, ink, varnishes, and glue. Every Saturday morning, we sit down with an informed group of editors, journalists, art directors, and photographers to flip through their favorite periodicals.
There's a huge amount of arrogance going into this, but it's got confidence and pride, and that makes for a fantastic end result.
It's a matter of pride to be involved in certain magazines. It's not about the reach and numbers, it's about the reach and quality.
Matte or glossy, saddle stitched or perfect bound, The Stack is an hour of opinions, predictions, and proclamations about all the titles we hoard, archive, and savor.
There is a real difference, and the difference will become more sharply edged as time goes on.
The biggest breakfast buffet of magazines and newspapers is served up every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brûlé, and a passionate mix of print aficionados.
I think it's real when it's ink. You can take it home and it doesn't flicker.
You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. Let me take you back a few years now on Midori House, back indeed to the 17th century. Many historians have explored the Legion global crises of that era in an attempt to discover what, if anything, connected them, and what's more, what might have explained them. Our next guest argues that the devastating consequences of global climate change could explain the seismic political and social crises of the era. Scientific evidence apparently shows that the revolutions, invasions, regicides that reached almost every corner of the world were brought about and exacerbated by disrupted weather conditions that contributed towards estimated deaths of a third of the world's population. Jeffrey Parker is the historian and author of a new book, Global Crisis, War, Climate Change and Catastrophe in the 17th Century, which paints an extraordinary and stark picture of an incredibly tempestuous time. I'm delighted to say that Jeffrey joins me on the line now. Jeffrey, welcome to Midori House. Thanks for joining us. We're used to seeing military histories from you. Tell me, what led you to take this very, very different view and approach in this latest work?
It's something I've been interested in since the 70s. I teach European history as well as military history. And while I was at St. Andrews in Scotland, I became very interested in the, as you were saying in your introduction, the plethora of uprisings, revolutions, regicides of the mid-17th century. And one day I was listening to the radio. It's good to know that radio is still there in Britain.
Good man.
An interview with a man called Jack Eddy, who had just discovered that in the late 17th century there were no sunspots, and he made the rather feeble joke that the reign of the Sun King coincided with an absence of sunspots. So the sun loses its heat. And I thought, wow, what an extraordinary coincidence. And I began to think, well, was it a coincidence? Could perhaps the fact that there is a colder climate be associated with all these wars, regicides, revolutions, and rebellions, which I had seen in my other texts?
And Jeffrey, tell me, as you then researched and compiled the book, which is a sort of a magnificent tome, it tracks its way through all of these very complex times. Did the theory really seem to hold water? And indeed, did it... As you sort of researched it and got deeper and deeper into it, did you become more and more sort of excited by the fact that there were these extraordinary kind of confluences?
Overlooking that absolutely disgraceful pun, Tom, about holding water, yes, I became very excited. I could not have written this book in the 70s because although the... I see two archives. I see a human archive, which is more or less written materials, art, things that people have done, and a natural archive. The human archive was there. The natural archive was not. Now we have enormous amounts of record of proxy data, really. No one invents a thermometer until the 1650s and 60s. When they do, they find that the temperature is about 1 degree Celsius or centigrade less than it is today. But before that, there are all sorts of indices that it's a terrible time for harvests. And indeed, when we look at the human records of how much harvest is brought in, it's very, very low. There's various reasons why that could be. But when you see that, for example, tree rings are extraordinarily narrow, which means it's a lousy growing season, then you begin to think that these two are connected. And so I would say in the last 10 years, the situation for historians has been transformed by this addition of a natural archive. You can get it all online even through the NOAA site in the United States, which coordinates it, and through Euroclim Hist, which is edited out of the University of Bern. So there's more data now that we can handle, but everything I have seen links climate change to catastrophe.
That's very interesting, Jeffrey. I was going to actually ask you about an aspect of that, which was, as you made these connections, and as you said, the data clearly supports it, were you in some senses surprised, perhaps, that more historians haven't made these connections before? Because obviously, if you looked at things like long, harsh winters, cool, wet summers, the problems that would have on crops and food production, for example, there does seem to be a logical process. Do you think it's taken these developments, in terms of what you described there as the natural archive, to really allow historians, I guess, as well as scientists, to make those connections explicit?
Yes, I certainly suspected it, but there was no way I could prove it until the data came online. After all, we're all pessimists. I'm sure the Scots have not changed since I lived in Scotland. They're particularly pessimistic. Every year is the worst. I mean, newspapers are always, this is the worst year, the driest year, etc. But when you have a run of 1,000 years, and the 1640s stand out as the coldest, wettest, driest, whatever you want to do. It's extreme climate in the 1640s, the worst for 1,000 years. When those guys say, this is the worst we've ever seen, they're actually telling the truth. But you wouldn't know that unless you had the natural archive to corroborate a tendency towards pessimism.
Now, tell me, it's interesting you sort of raise this spectre of the press and the media and how it is so histrionic these days. I wonder, obviously, this kind of leads me to the present day, and you sort of think, well, if we can make these connections, if the data supports it, and if we have the great scientists and historians like Jeffrey who can pick these things together, what can we learn about the present day then? And more importantly, I guess, looking a little further ahead, can we track trends in weather and climate and perhaps, you know, try and predict the social and political upheaval that may be wrought as a result?
A simple answer, unfortunately, is no. It is not a predictor of climate. As you may have seen in the newspapers yesterday, that the 2009 Met Office forecasts were described as unhelpful, in that they completely predicted what was going to happen that year. We're not there yet. Another 10, 15 years, I think we'll be able to really predict what the climate's going to do because there's constant work, constant research, constant modeling. We're getting better and better and better. I mean, I can remember the 1960s and 70s when there was spectacular forecasts of the next day that were totally wrong. We're not there yet. We can do that, but we can't yet predict what's likely to happen in 2 or 3 months. So I don't think anything that I can say in my book about the 17th century can be applied to the big debate on climate today, whether we have climate global warming, whether we don't have global warming. I believe Northern Ireland at the moment is under snow, so is it global cooling? What the book does shed light on is how catastrophic even small changes in temperature can be, and how important it is to react quickly. Again, reading my newspaper, as I do here in Columbus, Ohio, I was looking at Northern Ireland and a debate yesterday blaming the authorities for not acting more quickly. And they said, well, we just didn't realize how serious it was. Well, you know, there's no excuse for that. You should be able to know very, very soon that, for example, the sheep farmers are cut off from their flocks and the sheep are going to die unless you get in there very quickly. We need to be more resilient. We need to have better responses. And that is, I think, a lesson that anyone can draw from this book.
And I hope they do indeed. The book is Global Crisis, War, Climate Change and Catastrophe in the 17th Century by Jeffrey Parker, published by Yale University Press. Jeffrey, thank you very much for joining me on today's edition of Midori House. We'll be back right after this with some music and a leaf through the influential works of Johann Sebastian Bach with author Paul Eli. Now, all that talk of regicide makes me think about people who maybe want to take over the world. And on that theme, let's hear from Tears for Fears. This is Everybody Wants to Rule the World. That was, of course, Tears for Fears with Everybody Wants to Rule the World. You're with Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Now, keeping it musical, what do Procol Harum, Jimmy Page, Spinal Tap's Nigel Tufnell, and the author, Paul Eli, all have in common? Well, the answer is a musical one. It's a love of Johann Sebastian Bach, the great composer and organist of the 18th century. Paul Eli, though, has gone beyond mere enthusiasm to write a critically acclaimed new book, which takes the reader on a polyphonic journey through Bach's life and through the pantheon of modern music to discover and explain exactly how pervasive the great man's influence has been. Paul joined me in the studio to explain his passion for Bach and to why exactly the tale of the influence of his music is so compelling. He began by telling me how his own score, entitled Reinventing Bach, began.
Through the radio, it's useful now that we're on the radio. I'm happy to be able to say that. I was a graduate student at Columbia University in New York. No money, lots of time, hunger to learn things. The station does a 10-day Bach festival every year around Christmas time. And I heard it, and I went back the next year and went back the next. It was 24/7 Bach, and it gave me the chance to get to know a composer in depth that I wouldn't have necessarily come to at all otherwise. I listened to the station for jazz or for bluegrass, and suddenly they cancelled regular programming, and there was Bach, and without having to decide what to buy or ask what the important works are, it was explained on the radio, and I was saturated, and I've never let go.
And so tell me then about the book, because it's not really a history, it's not a biography. Explain to us if you can, it's not easy briefly perhaps to encapsulate exactly what it is. How would you sort of characterize the book almost?
So the music of Bach is especially adaptable, let's say. Musicians say that, and we have the evidence. All sorts of different renderings of Bach over the 300 years since he composed it for orchestras and violins and singers and in churches, but then on synthesizer and on mandolin and in commercials, movies, what have you. The book tells the story of how Bach's music has been reinvented with great aplomb and intensity since recordings became ubiquitous about 80 years ago. A couple of things happened in the 30s right together. The price of phonographs dropped, radios became ubiquitous. Suddenly this technology that had been there for a while was common. Suddenly recorded music was as available as live music. What happened next is the story of the book. From the 30s up to the present time, the way we listen to music and the way we communicate musically has been reinvented again and again. LPs, movie soundtracks, stereo, cassette, CD, digital files. And each of those reinventions has coincided with an amazing reinvention in the music of Bach. So I told those two stories together because they're really, I think, our story, the way we experience music in our lives today.
That's really interesting. I just wonder then, as in some ways music becomes more almost fragmented, certainly more accessible with the development of digital, what's that done to Bach and to the way people experience and engage with him and his work? Do you think that's been another profound change?
I do. Basically, when recordings first became ubiquitous in the 30s, people were afraid they were going to kill live music and they were going to kill serious interest in classical music. Didn't really happen. Live music occupies a different place in our society than it once did. There aren't amateurs playing in the town square as regularly as, let's say, a century ago, but there are plenty of world-class musicians, and you only have to be in a city like London to know that that's the case. At the same time, all these reinventions of Bach, what strikes me as something like miraculous about them is that Bach always comes through. Switched on Bach, that famous synthesizer record from the 60s, it's a synthesizer record, but it's not a gimmick. It's really the music of Bach. I heard the music of Bach as music on the phone while I was on hold with my publisher yesterday, and that then stuck in my head for the rest of the afternoon. Right now, somewhere else in London, Pasolini's film version of the Gospel According to St. Matthew is showing, and underneath that is the Bach St. Matthew Passion. And people are going to go see that movie not expecting to get Bach, but there it'll be, and they'll walk out with it in their brains.
And what is it about him and his work that enables it to be, it almost seems, more pervasive perhaps than some other, even of the great composers? Is there something unique, something hard to define, or do you feel that in researching and writing the book you've got closer to what that particular quality might be?
Well, it goes right to the heart of the book. There's an English scholar named Lawrence Dreyfus who argues that Bach was essentially an inventor. He invented instruments, he mastered and perfected the greatest musical invention of his time, the pipe organ. He composed works that he called inventions, and this principle of invention, making a piece of music that you develop just enough so that it can be used and turned into new things by others, is the essential compositional principle of Bach. It's convincing as a theory, but it's all the more convincing when you hear all these reinventions of Bach. People just keep doing new things with the music, and it somehow remains itself. It's harder to do with the music of, say, Beethoven, where there's a life story and a personal crisis in the middle of some of the works. Bach's music has an impersonality and an adaptability that I would say other great composers' music doesn't have.
I don't want to sort of put you on the spot, Paul, but in the spirit of a kind of Desert Island Disc scenario, if you could only have one then of these Bach recordings from those early days on the radio, right the way through all of your research, is there one? Can you choose one, or is it an impossible task?
I'd take a record by a singer named Lorraine Hunt Lieberson. It's a crazy story. She was raised by a musician. She played viola. She got to the level where she was playing in orchestras, professional orchestras. And somebody said to her, look, you've got an amazing voice. You've got to develop that. She wound up becoming really the most representative great singer of our time, able to express the whole range of emotions without seeming like one of those forbidding opera singers who wears a gown and makes you feel inferior. Then she records a fair amount of Bach. She gets cancer, and she brings her experience as a sick person to Bach's sacred arias about parting, about leaving this world. And the result is something that's just sublime, totally of our time, and something that couldn't have existed before recordings and before a whole revival in Baroque music that's happened over the last 30 years.
That was the author, Paul Eli, talking to me about his new book, Reinventing Bach, and his continuing passion for the works of the great composer. I'm afraid that's all we have time for on today's episode of Midori House. My thanks to our producer, Alla John, our researchers, Alexandra de Kramer and Barbara Feeney, and of course, our studio manager, Sam Impey. Up next after the news is this week's premiere of The Menu with Marco Sippi. Midori House returns with a striking new look and fresh sound at its brand new time of 8 a.m. London time on Monday. Until then, thanks for listening.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex. Thank you.